Welcome back to Mind Over Matter. I'm Dr. Elaine Schroeder, and with me in the studio tonight is Christina Love. We've been talking about her own, how her own life experiences have led her in the direction of becoming an advocate for women who are homeless, who suffer from addiction and domestic violence and sexual assault. So what I'd like to do is now take a look at how generational trauma and historical trauma have impacted you. But first, what I'd like to do is take a look, understand how that term came about. It was first recognized with academically, I'd say, in the children of Holocaust survivors. And I myself have been a therapist to Holocaust survivors, and you could see that their own life experience has backed up the research that, for example, the original study found that there was three times the number of Holocaust survivors in Canada, in a Canadian study, that were seeking psychiatric help compared to the normal population. And then generational trauma has been documented in descendants of slaves, of Native Americans, of war survivors, refugees, as well as survivors of interpersonal abuse. So historical trauma has to do with a shared experience amongst a group of people. And it, in general, historical trauma consists of three factors: the widespread nature of the trauma, traumatic events resulting in collective suffering, and that the suffering is caused by malicious intent of those who are inflicting the trauma. So we could say colonization of Native Americans is an example. Slavery of black people in the United States is an example. And historical trauma can result in a loss of identity and meaning, which then can in turn affect generations upon generations historically. So, Christina, could you talk some about how this transgenerational or generational trauma, and then specifically historical trauma, has impacted your life and the life of Alaska Natives?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for being a natural educator and for, you know, spreading that awareness and giving people that information. I think it's really, really important. And so I call this the liberation through education. I think it has been incredibly healing for me to understand the stories behind the story. And so, for instance, I talk about, you know, that my father had done grave harm to his own children, but understanding that, you know, that he had also survived that harm, and that that dichotomy of a victim and perpetrator, you know, is really important to understand, you know, that violence is a learned behavior, and that that was something that he had learned, you know, or that not every trauma survivor becomes a perpetrator, but most perpetrators were once trauma survivors themselves. That story is incredibly important to understand. Or the story of my mother, you know, who was born with developmental disabilities and autism, and understanding that her family, you know, also comes from a very long line of abuse, of physical abuse, of sexual abuse, of alcohol, of suicide, you know, bringing into present day. So then you have me, you know, who has survived physical abuse, sexual abuse, that I've survived suicide and addiction. And these things, violence, addiction, mental illness, often play out in three or more generations. We see them again and again. So for the story of Alaska Native people, it's important that we understand that violence is a learned behavior, you know, that, and that colonizers were our first abusers, you know, that rape is a very powerful tactic of war and how you take land and in how you colonize and in how you assimilate. And so for understanding addiction, there could be no greater message than for children to know the science of addiction, you know, how it is a disease of the brain, Because if they knew that their parents didn't choose alcohol over them, that's incredibly liberating. If you understood the full science of addiction, that it is not a moral failing, that it is a disease, there's so much liberation in that. So for me, first to understand that addiction is not a moral failing, that it is a it is the causation and the correlation to the abuse that I had survived. You know, that it was a very powerful form of coping, that that addiction, alcohol and drugs kept me alive for a long time, that I needed it to survive because I didn't have any other means of dealing with the trauma that I had survived, the flashbacks, the pain, you know, the emotional, you know, all of those things that come up from violence. So in a lot of ways, you know, alcohol kept me alive. It's because they're painkillers. Alcohol is a painkiller. Yeah. Cocaine is a painkiller, you know, as well as, you know, what led to my heroin addiction was painkillers, you know, doctor prescribed pain medicine. And so understanding that I wasn't a bad person, that I was just very unwell, was incredibly liberating, you know, to know that, you know, and then to understand the history, like, of incarceration, and to think of myself more as a political prisoner, you know, that shifts the onus from me than to understanding that the system
is
broken.
Well, that's a strong statement. Okay, could you unpack that? Thinking of yourself as a political prisoner.
Right. Seeing, you know, the history of mass incarceration, right, that Alaska Native people only make up 16% of the population, but we make up 57% of the population that's incarcerated. And then we start to understand, you know, that 90% of the people that are incarcerated are there for drug-related charges, and that 50% of the population have fatal alcohol syndrome, you know, and 90% of the population have mental health. But I would say that, you know, either you have mental illness coming in, but no one leaves incarceration without some type of mental illness. And that doesn't have to be lifelong. That can be the temporary effects of living in solitary confinement, you know, to the constant noise, that it is a difficult environment to learn how to be in and to adapt. And you take on coping mechanisms that we know to be mental illness, disassociation, like cognitive impairments, you know, that fuzzy feeling and difficulty concentrating and focusing and retaining information. Those are all normal effects of trauma. I mean, and that's another learning as a child that, you know, if you have survived trauma and you're having difficulty reading or difficulty retaining information, that's totally normal. And if you don't understand that, then you grow up thinking that you're stupid.
Yes.
You know, and for me to know that, you know, to understand that even if I can't remember the paragraph I just read, you can still be brilliant. You can still be a genius, is really important. And, you know, and then furthermore, you know, I think we talked about that internalized oppression of what do people say about Alaska Native people? You know, like that I carried all of this internal shame for being an Alaska Native person because I came from a family that struggled with both of those. And then to also have my own struggle with alcoholism and homelessness.
Do you know if any of your family had been forced to attend residential schools?
Yes. Yeah. My grandmother and then my mother, they placed her to live with Russian Orthodox nuns. And I don't know if it was a boarding school or not. I know that they placed her there so that because she was born with a disability prior to the 1960s. If you were born with a disability, you were removed from your home. And so they made that tough decision to place her with Russian Orthodox nuns because it was illegal to have a mental illness. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if it was a boarding school. I know that my grandmother and my great-grandmother were both in boarding schools.
And that is just a classic case of historical trauma because you have in Canada and in the U.S. Descendants of Indigenous students who were at residential schools. They're removed from their culture. They're removed from their family. They lack models for parenting. And what kind of message do you get when you're not allowed to speak your own language? Your hair is cut. Have you ever seen pictures of – I've seen just horrific pictures of before and after. And there'd be some residential school in the lower 48 at the around the turn of the century or the 30s or even 40s where the child comes in from a lower 48 tribe and – they've got beautiful long hair and they're in their own cultural clothing. And that's the before shot. And then the school, with pride, had the after shot where their hair is shorn, they look absolutely demoralized and they're sitting there in a little school uniform. It just makes me sick to see those pictures.
Yeah, absolutely. Winston Churchill referred to it as the American Indian Holocaust. And Churchill said one time that he believed that Hitler paved the way to Auschwitz through the heart of America. That what American people did to their indigenous people is what made the Holocaust possible.
Oh, historians have proven that the Third Reich, that Hitler mm-hmm. actually looked towards America for the race laws.
Yeah.
For mm-hmm. how they treated indigenous people, obviously the race laws, the Jim Crow laws.
Yep. Well, and there's no doubt if we said, you know, was what happened in Germany a Holocaust? There's no doubt about it. And probably one of the most harmful effects of the American Indian Holocaust is that it isn't even recognized as a Holocaust.
Right.
And people would say,
genocide as a Holocaust.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and it's not just, I mean, and so when we compare the two, it's not just genocide, you know, but then there's also cultural genocide. You know, some of the other a lot of tribes that were completely wiped out and language genocide, you know, and I mean, there's so many different and in a lot of ways, we're still in the process of colonization here.
Well, and the introduction of smallpox infested blankets. I mean, the deliberate transmission of disease to otherwise unprotected indigenous population.
Yeah. I mean, the list goes on and on and on of, you know, all of the different. And I think that that's probably one of the most important stories, understanding what happened on this land, you know, understanding what happened here in America. And that, you know, if you remove someone's ability to parent, you know, you wipe out an entire generation that teaches the next generation to parent, those things don't just magically come back. And those lead us to the narratives that we have today. You know, when we talk about what do people tell you, what do people say about Alaska Native people? That is one of the most important questions that I ask audiences to think about. And I'll tell you, because I'm what's considered white passing. You know, I know what people say about Alaska Native people because they tell me because they don't think that I'm Native. And they tell me that they think that Native people are stupid. They tell me that they think that they're drunks. They tell me that they think that they can't parent their children, that they're lazy, that they don't go to school. And, you know, without understanding the full story, if all you're seeing is people that are incarcerated, that are homeless, you know, that are struggling with alcohol, that 60% of Alaska Native children that are removed and placed in OCS care are never returned. Like that's a completely different type of, you know, we're out of the removal era and we're in a different era. Looking at the history of, you know, of the Declaration of Independence and the Supreme Court, you know, what the Supreme Court said about indigenous people, you know, and all these different laws that were legal. They did this legally. Mm-hmm. And, you know, without that information and without the full story, then you blame people for how they survive. You know, so that's where we talk about, you know, looking at ourselves as political prisoners, you know, rather than a moral failing.
It'd be very interesting. Have you ever, you know, thought about how history is taught, say, in grade school, high school, about the genocide of Native Americans and the cause and effect that basically about transgenerational trauma? That if you have a whole generation that is highly traumatized, the whole culture is ripped away from people, that it is a completely predictable result that even generations later, you're going to have people impaired mm-hmm. by that early mm-hmm. trauma. But see, what's interesting, and this is true in the case of Native Americans, it's true for Black people, not to mention Japanese who were interned during World War II, how they are treated today can reinforce that earlier trauma. We were talking about that earlier in the show, that that attitude towards Alaska Natives, for example, the negative stereotype, then just complete, you know, basically blaming the victims of colonialization and earlier trauma.
Yeah,
reinforces that trauma.
There's so many different levels of oppression, and yeah, that's absolutely one that with that systemic oppression. that happens, and how, you know, laws are written, you know, and the unintended consequences of policy when policy is made by people who represent the dominant culture rather than people who are directly impacted.
How do you feel? I mean, it would make sense to be very angry, as you were when you were in treatment, about this whole situation. So as you gain more and more knowledge of the intricacies of the impact of colonization, the impact of racism, the impact of earlier laws, how do you deal with your own emotions? I would think it would be really tough not to feel a lot of anger.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that, you know, what I've learned in my process of healing is to give honor and space and acknowledge and to accept those things as they arise. You know, I spent a lot of time working to not be angry so that I could blend into society, you know, by watching people and how they behaved and how they talked to one another so that people would know that, you know, that I was a trauma survivor or that I struggled with addiction or that I was previously homeless or that I'd been incarceration or in psych wards, you know, that if I walked on the street, you couldn't tell those things about me. And so I spent so much time regulating those emotions to have them come up in totally different ways, you know. And then I struggled with a lot of anxiety and sleeping, and you know, and I think that it's been a process to really learn how to feel those and to learn how to be, you know, and as things come up, that every one of them has importance, you know, that the anger has importance, it's there to burn off things, or that sadness has an importance, and it's there to clean things out, and, you know, to really allow myself to be completely whole in every situation. And I think that I tell people that I laugh as much as I cry because I'm paying attention, you know, that this life is incredibly hilarious and so beautiful. And I have so much to be grateful for. And I cry a lot and I get mad a lot. And I think that, as we should, you know, there are a lot of injustices. And as we go through each century and each generation, that those injustices are still there. They just have a different name. And so, like looking at the American Indian Holocaust and genocide, for me, that's still very much alive. Missing and murdered Indigenous women, you know, that's an obvious way of looking at people being murdered. But then we think about all the other ways of suicide, you know, and what's the percentage of suicide here in Alaska? And what's the percentage of overdoses? And what's the percentage of alcohol-related deaths? And then looking at how trauma is stored in the body and how that manifests in illnesses. You know, what's the percentage of Alaska Native people that don't live past 55? You know, then waste and incarceration and, you know, like there and murder. And, you know, I mean, like there's so many different ways to say, like, we are still dying.
Yes. And it's not over.
And that's incredibly, and who wouldn't be mad about that or sad about that? And I think it's worrisome when we stop feeling, you know.
How does your work with domestic violence and sexual assault victims fit into your recovery and your healing? How does that work for you?
I call it trauma mastery. You know, everything that I know that helps another person is because I've figured out and have sought out in some way to understand myself more and to understand my experiences. There are three major words for me when I think about advocacy and working with another person. And one is to acknowledge. The other one is to normalize and to validate. Mm-hmm. And so everything is about, you know, honoring my experience, and however people act in response to that is totally normal. And so it's been important, you know, to understand those things for myself, because I can only take people as far as I've gone, and, you know, and to create a sense of peace that I can bring them into. Uh-huh. I think about from my experience, you know, what things were pivotal for me, and what characteristics of people really helped me, and to try and embody those and become those. And I think that it gives me incredible meaning to be able to say that I don't regret the things that have happened to me or the path that I've taken, so that I can sit with another human being. And they know without a doubt that they're not alone. And most importantly, no matter what they're going through, I know that recovery is possible because I've been there. And that's probably the most important part, is that no matter what it looks like, no matter how far down the path that they've gone, and I know that recovery is always possible. And holding that hope, there could be no greater thing to do for me.
Well, you're speaking truth to power when you're talking to legislators. And I'll never forget a school board meeting many, many, many years ago where AWARE was working to get a sexual abuse prevention program into the schools, and it was being fought roundly by a particular segment of Juno. And I attended a meeting because as a psychotherapist, one of my specialties was working with victims of incest and childhood sexual abuse. And a woman stood up and spoke as an incest survivor herself. And it was so powerful that it impacted everybody in the room. And the school board, of course, unanimously passed the motion was needed to have AWARE come in and do sexual abuse prevention programming in the school. And I can imagine what you were talking about earlier, speaking to legislators. You've also been to Washington, D.C., as I understand. What brought you there?
We were there for the Brett Kavanaugh hearing. And the ACLU had sent up quite a few lawyers. Mm-hmm. And there was a group of people that said, you know, that Alaska Native people are most impacted by sexual assault. And mm-hmm. it's important that their voice and experience also be heard. And so there was a group of Alaska Native women survivors that went and we met with Murkowski's office and Dan Sullivan and spoke to a lot of different reporters and talked about our experience and how important it is that people understand, you know, what's happening here in the state.
And what are you doing? Are you working on any laws right now, any legislation statewide?
So the last time I was there in D.C., we were talking about the intersectionality of substance use and trauma. Mm-hmm. And we were talking about mental health and substance use coercion and in ways that, you know, people are vulnerable not because of their disability, but because they're targeted for their disability. And so we were there's a couple of different laws that we're working on for women who are trafficked. And there's a law that they haven't been able to pass here. I don't think it's that's even going to be proposed this year. But one of them was looking at how law enforcement are allowed to have sex with sex workers and able to get a conviction of prostitution. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of pushback on that, you know, that they believe that it's, you know, that's the only way. We know that that's, you know, incredibly harmful, as well as thinking about, you know, all the different ways that women don't report sexual assault. So like what they've done in Colorado, it's really interesting because of the Kobe Bryant case. His sexual assault. What they did after that, because of the huge media campaign for victim shaming, was that they created rape shields, that would keep victims' identity private so that they couldn't be shamed.
Oh, excellent. Excellent. Well, Christina, our time is winding down for this show. I really want to thank you for your work to affect the social and legal changes needed to eliminate oppression and violence against women and children. But I really most want to thank you for sharing your personal, powerful, very, very powerful story. I'd like to also thank Shelley Delaney for being such a technical wizard, even when sometimes things go wrong, and for producing tonight's show. And lastly, I would like to thank all of you for listening in tonight. So please join us next month on another Monday evening at 7 p.m. for yet another edition of Mind Over Matter. Thanks, Christina.
Thank you.
And good night, everybody.